Only say smart things.
So we're studying Kuzari together, and we will get into it. We'll begin really delving into the text, but I wanted to give a little bit of background before we did. Some of you may have had a chance to read some background information, whether in the introduction in this particular edition or elsewhere. I wanted to give a little bit of an overview of the world of the Kuzari, the history of the Kuzari, and the historicity of the Kuzari. A little bit about who Yehuda HaLevi was, what the Kuzari is about and why it is unique, and then we'll get into it. Yehuda HaLevi was born in the year 1075. Some claim it was 1085. That's not accurate. He was born in 1075 in Spain, in Toledo, which was one of the seats of the Golden Age. Shortly before he was born, it had been conquered by the Kingdom of Castile. And during that time, Spain passed from Islamic control, Arab Islamic control, to Christian control, and the culture changed as well. The imprint of the Islamic culture, the Moorish culture, on Spain can be seen, of course, in many different ways. Most notably, or obviously, the architecture. And then after that, that was when, at that time, right around the time that Yehuda HaLevi was born, Christian influence began to become stronger, and of course that had many ramifications hundreds of years down the line, for example, with the Spanish Inquisition. This was the period known as the Golden Age of Spain, leading up to the transition of control from Islamic control to Christian control. It was an era of unprecedented intellectual development, and Jews received broad education, and they were allowed a lot of access, and even rose to positions of power and prominence. And when I talk about broad education, I'm talking about scripture, Talmud, and Arabic poetry, philosophy. An educated Jew during that time was a very well-rounded Jew, and Yehuda HaLevi was that. He was heavily influenced, especially by Arabic poetry. And he himself was a prolific poet. Many of his compositions are known to us, and actually in our tradition at least, are read especially on Tisha B'Av. There's a whole section in the Tisha B'Av Kinos, one of the prayers beginning with the word Tzion, written by Yehuda HaLevi, expressing his yearning for the land of Israel. When he was a young man, he moved to the south of Spain. The center of Torah in Spain was in the south, and that was where Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi, known as the Rif, he had come from Morocco, Alfasi, and also Rabbi Yitzhak ibn Migash, the Rim Migash, he was there living in the south of Spain at the time as well. And so in addition to his significant Torah accomplishments, he was receiving acclaim for his poetic soul and his poetic accomplishments and output as well. One of the great poets in Spain at the time was Moshe Ibn Ezra, a relative of the Avraham Ibn Ezra. By the way, the legend is that Avraham Ibn Ezra was the son-in-law of Yehuda HaLevi. That hasn't been substantiated in any way. It's a nice thing to talk about. They knew each other. Avraham Ibn Ezra refers to Yehuda HaLevi and to knowing Yehuda HaLevi, but doesn't refer to him as his father-in-law. So there's no we don't have any proof that they were related at all. Moshe Ibn Ezra was one of the great poets, and one of the themes in Moshe Ibn Ezra's poetry is repentance over a wasted life. Moshe Ibn Ezra apparently lived large as a young man, and later in life had a change of heart. So a lot of his poetry, especially later in life, is about his regret for having wasted his youth. Some of Moshe Ibn Ezra's poetry actually still is still recited. If you've ever been on Yom Kippur to a Sephardic shul, there is a piyut that they say before Ne'ilah called El Nora Alilah. God, the mighty God of Alilah, referring to plans, the God who is the God over all, what we decide in this world. So El Nora Alilah Hamse Lanu Mechila Bishat Hane'ilah. So that poem, grant us forgiveness at the time of Ne'ilah, at the time of the gates closing. That poem was composed by Moshe Ibn Ezra. And still is an important part of the Sephardic liturgy. Yehuda Halevi won a contest for his ability to mimic the poetry of Moshe Ibn Ezra, and they developed a relationship as well. Yehuda Halevi moved to Granada, and at that point he studied medicine. He was a physician. That was his livelihood. It was also a source of inspiration for him. He brought spiritual aspects of healing into his writings as well.
Kind of parallels Rambam.
many similarities. He lived before, he lived before the Rambam, but there are many similarities. The Rambam wasn't a poet by any means. In fact, the life story is the same, but you couldn't find two thinkers who were more in opposition, as we will see. Yehuda Halevi was, in many ways, the anti-rationalist. We'll talk about that. Yehuda Halevi wrote his prose in Arabic and his poetry in Hebrew. So the Kuzari is actually a translation from the Arabic. So any translation that we have, unless it's a direct translation from the original Arabic, is a translation of a translation. That's worth knowing when we study it together, that sometimes what we may be reading, and I guarantee in this translation here is a translation of a translation. It's not the original. And the themes that he addresses in his poetry, talks about nature, he gives biblical riddles, he talks about the pleasures of life, sometimes he sometimes wrote poetry on the occasion of funerals. So a lot of the common themes that Hebrew poets were talking about, they were themes that Yehuda Halevi spoke about as well. At a certain point in his life, Yehuda Halevi learned of a legend, for him it wasn't so much a legend, it was a rumor that he wanted to know more about a kingdom in the East where all of the inhabitants, all the subjects, had converted to Judaism. That kingdom was the Khazar kingdom. A lot of the legends of the Khazars that were for a long time considered by historians to be false. But more and more evidence shows that at least what Yehuda Halevi thought about them was based on some degree of truth. The Khazars were a nomadic, semi-nomadic Turkic people who lived in now the area of what encompasses the part of the Caucasus known as Dagestan. There's actually Jews that still live there. They're called the Mountain Jews. So they lived there, and it was really a very strategic location because they held some of the important posts along the Silk Road. In many ways, they were on the crossroads of influence. On the one hand, the spread of Orthodox Christianity toward the West and Islam toward the East. One of the theories suggested as to why the king of the Khazars, King Bulan, converted to Judaism was that it was to get the Christians and the Muslims off his back because they were both vying for his custom and his attention. So the area of the Khazars actually extended quite, it was quite a wide area. In this book, there is actually a map. It extends toward, from the Caucasus to the Crimea, an area that was in the news a little bit more of late, with Vladimir Putin's advances toward that particular area, but this was the area of their influence. The king was King Bulan. Sometimes between 954 and 961, the philosopher Chastai ibn Shaprut, living in Spain, wrote a letter to King Joseph of Khazaria. He was the successor several kings later to King Bulan, and this is known as the Khazar correspondence. This is one of the important documents. It was discovered in the Cairo Geniza later on. Important documents substantiating the claims of conversion by the Khazars, and it is probably the source that Yehuda Halevi had on which he built the Khuzari. King Bulan is said to have had angelic visitations. He claimed that he received angelic visitations, that he experienced visions in a dream that exhorted him to find the true religion. And he hosted debates in his palace between representatives of the three major religions that he knew about. Actually, the Khazars were animist, at least in part. They held animist beliefs that God is found throughout nature. So he had held debates, or at the very least, sessions with leaders from other religions, such as Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Those were the three religions that were in residence, at least at the time that he was there. The three Abrahamic religions. That is the background to how Yehuda Halevi knew about the Khazars, but as we will see, as we learn, this idea of a debate, and the Khuzari is set up as a dialogue between representatives of different religions and different philosophies of life and this king. The historicity of the Khuzari, as far as the book the Khuzari is concerned, is actually beside the point. It's really a framing device. A king who is trying to search for different religions for a path in life is interviewing and asking probing questions of representatives of each of these religions. That's designed to bring out Yehuda Halevi's conception of those religions and to refute them, or to and in the case of Judaism, to explain those philosophies. It doesn't really matter whether there actually ever was a king of the Khuzari or not. This device is designed to present Yehuda Halevi's worldview. Yehuda Halevi's worldview is completely unapologetic. If we read, or when we read, the Khuzari now, we will see that it is really not politically correct to say a lot of the things that Yehuda Halevi said. So it's very tempting to read the Khuzari in an apologetic light and try and explain that he doesn't mean what he says, that you can't really say that, and therefore we're not going to say that. So we're not going to read the Khuzari apologetically. We're going to read the Khuzari as Yehuda Halevi wrote the Khuzari, unapologetically, meaning we're not going to offer justifications or explanations or contextualize. We're just going to read. I mean, if you want to engage in that, it'll certainly be interesting to hear what you have to say, but it's worth noting that is us imposing a reading on Yehuda Halevi. He was not apologetic about anything that he wrote. We will see.
Did he face any backlash for his writing?
It is important to contextualize why he was writing what he wrote. That is true. In other words, why is he being unapologetic? Is it to strengthen the people that are wavering? Is it to strengthen himself, or is it because this is his genuine belief? And the question is to whether he got into trouble for what he wrote. I don't think so.
Is there an intro of who he's writing it for?
We'll see. As we go along, we'll see. It's not just who he's writing it for. It's in what framework he is writing it, who he's responding to. At the time, we're talking about the spread of Christian influence and the attractiveness also of certain Islamic philosophers that were gaining popularity in Spain at the time that he was responding to. The full title of the work commonly known as the Khuzari is The Book of Arguments and Proofs in Defense of the Despised Religion. So that kind of gives you a sense of why he was writing that. And the Khuzari is written in the form of a dialogue. This is evocative of the works of Plato. Plato wrote in a dialogue as well. So the Khuzari is almost a Platonic dialogue. He presents his teachings in the framework of a discussion. There are usually two characters in the discussion. And then, as in any dialogue, there's the third character who is the one who is listening and receiving the dialogue. And that's really the intended audience that Yehuda Levi is speaking to. During the time of Yehuda Levi, other religions were seen to be more universal, more relevant, Christianity, Islam, and in more respectable, socially respectable. So Judaism had some explaining to do to show why it's not hopelessly anachronistic. And that's why he presented it in the form of a dialogue to make it interesting and relevant to the people that were reading it. Another reason that he might have used the dialogue form is that one of the main messages, as we'll see, of the Khuzari is the idea of tradition. That, and not just tradition, but the primacy of tradition over actual learning. Not so much book learning, but experience and the experiential versus the intellectual. That's really the common and dominating theme of the Khuzari, which is in many ways an anti-intellectual, anti-philosophical work. And so writing it in a dialogue form shows that it is the dialogue, the back and forth between and the person who is speaking often is the rabbi. The idea that in order to receive the tradition, you have to have a dialogue with a spiritual mentor, that's one of the other themes that that emerges in through a vast majority of the work of the Khuzari. With that in mind, let's begin. And of course, feel free to read in any language that you know or that you have in front of you. Anybody want to go? I'm happy to start, or anybody want to jump in?
You're starting first essay.
First essay, right from the beginning.
The introduction commented a little bit on the divisions. But I wasn't entirely clear. It said that, like, the large divisions were, I can't remember who, one of them was attributed to Halevi, but I think they were saying that some of the subdivisions may have just been because otherwise they were so long that they needed to be broken down. I don't know if you have any recollection of
that. I think that's true.
Divisions of what? Of
meaning
the first of the essay, book. And then there are the verses are numbered. Because there's actually three, at least in here, they use three numbers for any given
verse
or something.
There's like the second essay, the 80th paragraph, the third clause.
Yeah, whatever. Okay. Yeah. So that's, I was just curious. All right.
Yeah.
All right. I was asked to provide refutations to those philosophers and religionists who dissent from us, including Jewish sectarians who dissent from traditional Judaism.
So that, who do you think that, there, if you read the footnote, he says it.
Karaites?
That's the Karaites. In this sense, by the way, Yehuda Halevi and the Rambam were both fighting the same battle, even though they're coming from different perspectives. The Rambam was also fighting the Karaites, actually everybody was fighting the Karaites at the time. One of the, they were viewed as, it seems quaint nowadays, but the Karaites were viewed as a major threat to rabbinic Judaism and to the transmission of rabbinic Judaism. Tzvi, you're looking at me like I'm...
I'm just Googling the answer. Who lived first?
The Rambam lived in, as I recall...
Afterwards.
Yeah, afterward. The Rambam lived afterwards. But I was setting up the contrast between the Rambam and Yehuda Halevi, the Rambam being the ultimate rationalist and Yehuda Halevi being an anti-rationalist, but they were both responding in different ways to the...
No, I understand.
Correct.
I was curious if
were they contemporaries at all?
The first.
Yeah, I don't... Yeah, Yehuda Halevi lived...
is there any evidence whether Rambam had read anything from Yehuda Halevi?
I don't know. I don't. It wouldn't surprise me. Although I don't know that the Rambam, that poetry was really the Rambam's bag. Right? I don't know if that was. But whether he read the Kuzari or not, I don't know. I'm sure there is some scholarship about that. I just don't know.
Wasn't it considered a major work at that point in time, or was there any subsequently?
When did the Kuzari take off? I think that it was pretty. I think that it gained traction pretty quickly. So it doesn't. It may be that given their geographical, you know, location, it would make sense that the Rambam might have come across it. So already we're setting up the. In some ways, if you want to call it the straw man of the philosopher, the first person to present, if the Kuzari is a battle between different religious worldviews, a debate between different religious views or different religious leaders presenting their views to a king, the first person to present is used to a king as a philosopher who doesn't necessarily hold any particularly religious worldview. So that's and the general spread of the study of philosophy is one that Yehuda Halevi is addressing here. Go ahead.
This made me remember the arguments of the rabbi who studied with a Khazar king who converted to Judaism some 400 years ago. The king's story is faithfully recorded in history books. It begins with the king having a recurring dream of an angel who appears to him and tells him, "Your intentions are desirable to the Creator, but not your deeds." The king had become deeply engrossed in the Khazar religion to the point where he himself would administer in the Khazar shrines and tend to the sacrifices, which he did with a full heart. But even though he would become involved with these rites, he would still be visited in a dream at night by the angel. Who would continually tell him your intent is desirable, but your deeds are not.
Okay, so a few things. First of all, would we hadn't discussed just a few moments ago, why would the philosopher be first? If we have a, if we're setting up a debate between different worldviews, why would the philosopher's worldview be presented first?
Because it was non-sectarian. It's kind of a neutral.
Good. Start off easy, right? There's no particular. Nobody's going to be alienated when you start with somebody who's just a philosopher. Anybody else?
Hey, where do you see that he's just starting with the philosopher?
Is it
just in the order?
The first is mina philosoph. Yeah, the first.
The order.
Yeah, the first thing that we're talking about is you'll see. We'll see as you go.
I think that from the way he describes the vision, the angelic vision that the Khazar king has, is actually philosophical in its approach, because the idea that there is this kind of unified way of thinking, which is philosophical, can have its particular. If you have right philosophy, it doesn't make a difference if you act. You know, if you put on three pairs of tefillin or one pair of tefillin, or you have your Passover on one day or the other day, the particulars of the religion are not nearly as important as the philosophical right thinking and right heart.
So are you saying that that's what was, that's what people thought, and he's counteracting that, or
no,
that's what he
wants. Even the way he's describing the angel
mm-hmm.
is a philosophical position. Meaning, if the angel will come and say, you have a right, it's a response to a philosophical position. If an angel is going to come and say, you have the right thinking, but you don't have the right action,
right,
that is a response
to
the philosophical claim that the right action is hardly as important as right thinking.
That's right, that's right. Yeah, for sure. I mean, deed versus creed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is, I think what's interesting also is that it's in the form of a dream, right? So it already is setting up a non-rational construct, right? And try and explain that you're basing major life decisions on a dream. We have the notion of prophecy, as we'll see, Yehuda Halevi himself doesn't believe that non-Jews can receive prophecy. So this is not a prophetic vision within his own philosophical framework. So it's clearly this major life, this event that's this repeated vision in a dream is already setting up kind of an anti-rational perspective for the way, going forward for the way he views the world. But yeah, that I think that's really good. That your intentions are desirable, but not your deeds, is the response to it. Doesn't matter what you do, as long as you think as long as you believe the right things, or you have sort of.
And then he repeats it by saying, "Your thinking is pleasing to God," which is goes from your beliefs to your thinking, which is really kind of hitting both those issues.
Right. So.
Beliefs, maybe religious beliefs, thoughts, maybe philosophical thoughts.
Right. Is that from the translation?
I'm on the straight translation.
Right, the straight translation. Is it the word, the phrase in Hebrew is repeated.
Right.
It's kavanatcha ritzuya etzel habore, aval ma'asecha einam ritzuya. So kavanatcha ritzuya can be translated variously as your intentions or your intent is desirable, but not your deeds. So translating it as your thought.
They both say that your way of thinking, but in the explanation it says that he was perfect heart. He devoted himself with a perfect heart.
Right.
And then the quote, direct quote is your way of thinking.
Your way of thinking, yeah. Go ahead. Anyone else? Maybe? Anybody? This prompted the king to explore other belief systems and religions. Ultimately, the king, together with a great populace of Khazars, converted to Judaism. Many of the rabbi's arguments have given me peace of mind and are in accord with the way with my own way of thinking. And I have therefore decided to write, to record these arguments in dialogue form as they were originally presented. the Hebrew phrase is, Ra'iti lichtov hadrei mahem ka'asher naflu, in the way they happened, in this case in the form of a dialogue, and v'hamaskilim yavinu, hopefully perceptive readers will gain much understanding from them. Not just from the arguments themselves, but from the back and forth between the participants, the principals, in the arguments.
So this is Yehuda Levy saying that he found the arguments satisfying.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he says, at least in this translation, he says, I found the arguments of the rabbi, many appeal to me. Which rabbi is
he? Yeah, so we'll see that there are... and I should have explained. In the way that this is set up, where reflecting the debate that the Khazar king set up in his own palace between the representatives of the different faiths and the one-on-one dialogue that he had with the different representatives of those faiths, so too, in this account, there were different people presenting to the king. There was the philosopher, there was the Christian, the Muslim, and there was the rabbi. It's worth noting also that none of the people presenting are objective, except for maybe the philosopher, right? None of these people, everybody has a vested interest in the outcome of their presentation. We're not talking about just scholars of Judaism or scholars of Islam. We're talking about practitioners and leaders in those communities. So they are offering full-throated, passionate defenses of their own belief system. When the king realized that through his dreams, that his intent was desirable, but his actions were not, v'tzivahu b'chalom levakesh ha-ma'aseh ha-nirtza etzla boreh, he inferred that he should seek out alternate religious activity that would be favored by the Creator. In other words, if God is telling him, or if someone is telling him that God doesn't like what he's doing, then he should spend time figuring out what it is that he should be doing that God does approve of. And the operative word being doing, because his intent was just fine. There's nothing wrong with his intentions. And so he asked a prominent philosopher of his time about his faith. At this time, aside from certain Muslim philosophers that were gaining a lot of currency, Aristotelian philosophy was also becoming very popular in Spain, held in very high esteem, and he felt, it must be that he felt that his first avenue of truth, the first avenue to explore in trying to gain the truth, would be to reach out to and seek the counsel of philosophers who spent a lot of time in thinking about the truth and must certainly have arrived at it. So
seems like the backwards place to start. If the king receives an vision that he needs to do more and his actions need improvement, philosophers aren't any more the thinking type rather than the doing type. Go last for a philosopher.
Yeah, that's a good... Yeah.
Well, if you want to take... I mean, just to try to respond to that, I mean, I think the question is well placed. However, in the Muslim tradition of philosophers at that point in time, there's a great deal of effort in the parts of people like Al-Farabi and Avicenna and these kind of guys who, I don't know if he read them or not, to bring in this philosopher king ideal from Plato, which is really the application of philosophy into politics. Remember that Islam is not like Christianity that has a separation between the heavenly kingdom and the earthly kingdom. They are very much closer to Judaism, where everything is integrated. So in that sense, a philosopher maybe from the Islamic tradition would have had, or in the Islamic world ought to have a lot to say about, you know, the temporal powers.
Right. Avicenna, by the way, that's one of the Islamic philosophers that was very popular and that Yehuda Halevi was trying to counteract, was making inroads into the Jewish community at the time. Practical philosophy, although that seems like a contradiction in terms, that certainly was a school of thought at the time.
You know, I suppose, one of the footnotes in this text talks about that it was... Greek philosophy was held in high esteem, so, you know, in the ascendancy, whatever. If that were the case, I suppose somebody reading this at the time, if they're reading about one religion and then the other religion, etc., they may be thinking to themselves, well, you know, why are we futzing around with this religion versus that religion? I know that the preeminent thought in our time is that all of this is shamanism, and so... You know, let's hear from the philosopher because they're really going to lay waste to all of these arguments. So he gets it out of the way at the front, perhaps.
Right.
So
meaning, get rid of the argument against religion entirely,
right,
before getting into the nitty-gritty of which religion.
Yeah, that's anachronistic because there, in that time, even there's no way, nothing was viewed independently of religion. Even philosophy, you know, the philosophers were all persecuted. They were all trying to, you know, backhand, even like Rambam, trying to backhandedly influence religion with philosophy.
they can't. They didn't perceive the way.
You don't make it still.
Where they're not in the Enlightenment period where they see these two separate things right. The way we do.
Also, important that philosophers at the time weren't necessarily non-believers. They just believed in a detached God rather than a involved God, which is the first argument that that he sets up. Anybody? Go ahead, please.
Regarding the king's dream, the philosopher explained, God neither desires nor despises. He is above all human desires and intentions. This must be so, for a person who intends to do something is incomplete until he actually does what he intended to do. Only after he fulfills the intentions is he complete. And certainly, since God lacks nothing and is always complete, he cannot desire and intend anything.
This is a response to the dream, right? Your intention is good. Your actions are not desirable. That means that there is a gap between what is perfection and where you are. God is completely above that. He doesn't concern himself with the details of mortal lives. There is no gap between God's intent and God's desires. He is above all of that, all human desires and all human intentions.
Does it get into, as we go on, about what exactly are his actions that are so displeasing? Is it simply that they're not in keeping with a particular religion, or are they just kind of, is he just living in debauchery
It says he was offering. Right.
Offerings intended to sacrifices, right. Which he did with the full heart. He was just observing that form of ritual. And
It was very frum, but in a different, different religion.
It wasn't, right. It wasn't like a song of the martyr type of thing. It was more of kind of full in the wrong.
That's right. Yeah, very sincere, Khazar, observant person.
Furthermore, philosophers believe that God is too elevated to know the details of this world. This is so because all events that occur in this world are temporal. And God exists outside of temporality. God then never acquires any new knowledge and has no knowledge of you, and certainly does not know about your intentions or actions. Of course, then, God does not hear your prayers or see your movements.
This is the
philosopher's
this, right. This is not what the Khuzari or not Yehuda Levi holds. Although there were Jewish philosophers that believed some version of this kind of
detachment.
Yeah, yeah. One of the more famous expositors of this idea is the Ralbag, actually, for which he was pilloried. So again, he's setting up the philosophical, and it is worth noting that this is also by way of setting up the deed versus creed. In other words, in the sense that to the degree that your actions have to match up to your intention, he is setting up a perspective of God that for which there is no gap between action and intention, because God and that who doesn't care about your actions at all.
Philosophers say that God created you, which would imply that he knows about you. This is not to be taken literally. What is meant is that God is the ultimate source of all that exists, and not that God deliberately created you. God never created man. Rather, the universe has always existed, and has always existed, constantly being born in the previous generation, in the previous one before it, and so on.
So God is like God is not so much an origin. He's not the creator or the originator. He is sort of a supervisor, right? A manager, in some ways.
Does it view him as a manager, or just the person who flipped the switch to get everything going and then leaves it to its own devices?
It doesn't even say that God. When you say that God is the creator, it doesn't mean that he is the creator. It means that he is a presence, right? A detached presence. I think that's a good way of describing it. Not so much that he is, that the world that originated with him. It's that he's just there as the world evolves.
Observer.
Yeah, that's right. An observer, though, implies an interest in what's happening, but that even that can't be attributed to God. Continue, and we'll stop shortly. Go ahead.
A human being is composed of spiritual abilities, physical characteristics, and personality traits inherited from his parents and other relatives. Environment plays a role in a person's physical and emotional makeup. Air quality, geography, food and water specific to the region. Also, the planets, stars, and other celestial bodies all radiate various influence upon the individual.
It's interesting that...
You say air quality.
Air quality. Yeah. Like you lived.
They get something in the air in San Francisco that makes people believe they are.
But also interesting is that he says planets and stars and celestial bodies.
Why is that interesting? Or what?
Because that implies that astrological forces exert control over people's lives.
I don't know about that because.
You don't think so?
And this sounds like pretty basic Aristotelian science, and you know the different spheres in the bodies are all kind of lined up as the whole complicated science of how you get mm-hmm. to the human intellect and the active intellect and the passive intellect and all that kind of stuff is all, it's not necessarily,
you know, you think that these, right, these are just general things that
humanity and particular human beings evolve from,
right.
Emanate from in that terminology.
Okay, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think that's certainly a better...
Because they don't believe in astrology.
Who doesn't? I mean...
Like the philosophers, they don't...
Jewish...
That's the way we understand it.
At the time of Yehuda Halevi, a lot of Jewish philosophers did believe in astrology. I mean, the belief in astrology as a force in human life was not uncommon. We don't, but it was a common belief. I'm just saying the
philosophical.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So I think that your reading is probably the more accurate one. It's not.
In my translation, it has spheres, stars, and constellations, which is kind of a. That's like a classic Aristotelian.
Right.
Astrology. Huh?
No, it's astronomy, not astrology.
No, it's just, but I mean, there's a lot of astrology that they guided their thoughts on. Not Jews, but I mean, Jews were aware of it.
Jews believed in astrology. They did believe in astrology too.
Doesn't constellation in itself denote more of an astrology over astronomy?
No, it's an. I mean, there is a term.
Stars may be astronomy, but when you
it's an astronomical
into little,
term.
You know, creatures and things.
It's not in our modern conception of constellations. I think it has a different connotation.
Is the philosopher in essence just saying the angel is wrong?
He's saying that it's wrong in the sense that God doesn't care what you do.
which is why we find out later on that he one of the reasons why he rejects
the philosopher,
because he knows the dream he keeps having, where they say your intentions are good, but your deeds are not. And philosopher knew.
Right. So I think that we will stop here. Thank you for coming, and to those who read, thank you for doing that. And we will continue next time on December 12th. Hope to see you then.
What did you watch? You want to mention?
Yishema never let the